will know that we're harmless.
Okay,
finish.
Don't
worry about it.
I think Joanna will be joining. Okay, cool. Great, how are you?
Okay, so it is 3:30. I'm going to call the meeting of the Special Housing Committee to order. We'll do a roll call, which it's a very short roll call because only three of us. Greg McCullough is here. Jeff Collins is here. And Craig Lopez is not here. Do we have the agendas that those get handed out?
We do.
I need a copy of one of them.
I think you have the stack. Thank you. Is there else on the agenda?
Sorry.
You just wanted to sign in.
Sure.
Thank you.
I'll let everyone get organized here. Okay, so I'll call the meeting to order. I'm going to talk about our mission statement, what we're trying to do here, and how we're going to approach this. And it's not just up to me, it's up to the committee as a whole. So my thoughts on what we want to do with this committee is look at housing as a continuum, from those that are unhoused to those that can't afford housing to those that are in housing but may be kicked out of housing. So understanding the whole continuum of what it takes to get all of our residents adequate and reliable housing. I think that the first thing and the most important thing we can talk about initially is the emergency housing and unhoused and the people that are homeless, essentially. To begin that conversation, I did get some data from the executive's office, and I'll hand out some of this. So the sheets basically will show us how many homeless or unhoused people we have each quarter from 2018 until now. And if you look at the first sheet, this is the total number of individuals that are homeless on an average in each quarter. And as you can see, it's up and down, but it's been up recently the last three quarters. And then there's breakdowns of that by the next one is cases. That's the red sheet, the number of cases per quarter on average. And it's broken down to single men, single women, and families. And what this shows to me, and again, these are numbers from the executive's office, this shows to me that we are in a crisis and it's not getting any better. You know, the issue is not being resolved. We're not lowering the number of homeless. We're not working on that problem. Let me rephrase that. We're working on it, but what we're trying to do isn't solving it. And I think that's a policy issue. I think it's an issue that the legislature needs to look at and how we can take this kind of data, understand what the data means, and make policies and make decisions that make an impact on that data, make an impact on people being housed. So that's the first step that I want to look at and think about. And it's really going to be a discussion, and I think it's a discussion that I would invite anyone to participate in, just raise your hand and we'll call. I don't have an agenda other than that, other than discussion, because it's a new committee. I don't have resolutions to work on. So the next piece of data that I got was the total cost. This is a very preliminary cost on our graph on the cost, and I'll pass these out. This is only the cost that we pay for emergency housing. And again, it's if you look at the last few years, between 21 and 2022, the cost went up 40%. Between 22 and 23, the cost went up 67%, I believe it was. So in 2 years, we've doubled the cost of how much we spend on hotels and motels housing people. And right now it's over a $4 million. That's our cost. And that does not include what the state pays. The state pays as much as we pay, actually more than we pay. So it's $10 million of total cost to house people in hotels and motels in 2023, of which we pay $4 million. Doubling every 2 years is something that's not going to work really well for us long term. So again, we're reacting to what we need to react to. We're doing what we need to do to get people in, you know, temporary shelters, but it's not a sustainable process, in my opinion. So that's kind of where we're at as far as that goes. And I'd like to, you know, ask our committee member and visitors, you know, thoughts on that, or the executive team, what their thoughts are on that. So, go ahead.
I understand that DSS pays anywhere between $1,500 to $3,000 a month for a room. Why or how come they can't spend, let's say you spend $3,000 for a room for 1 month. Why don't we move that family that's in that room to an apartment for maybe $1,500 a month? Then you're getting $3,000 for 2 months. I'm not understanding the reasoning behind that.
I think there are rules around that, but I'm going to defer to either.
Well, I'm going to take it. Okay, yeah. So that's a great question, and it's a question that frequently gets posed, particularly when we're reviewing this information. So the answer to the question is that emergency housing programs are separately funded from permanent shelter benefit and permanent housing. So the two emergency housing programs that we utilize are TANF, which is temporary assistance for needy families, and that covers actually 100% of the costs that are incurred to emergency house a family. Safety Net is the program that we house individuals or childless couples with. And the Safety Net program is funded 71% by the county and 29% by the state. But the circumstances are neither one of the funding streams for emergency housing programs can be utilized to pay for the expenses that would be incurred to permanently house. And for that, there's what's called a shelter benefit. And the shelter benefit, unfortunately, is significantly lower. And I'll just give you the example. The example for a shelter benefit for a single individual is $444 a month. And that's all that would be available to a single individual who is seeking to find permanent housing. And right now, fair market value rents in Ulster County, even for a studio or one bedroom, are probably in the $1,000 to $1,200 range, if you can find any, because there's also an inventory shortage. So that is where a lot of the challenges exist. So someone who's in emergency housing at $100 a night in a motel, and we're spending $3,000 per month on that individual to keep them emergency housed, that money's not available for them to then be allocated to being utilized for a one bedroom or studio. The maximum benefit they would get would be $444.
The bigger question that you raise in terms of what our thoughts are on this trend, we agree this is not a good trend by any means, and that's why we've tried to take many different measures over the last couple of years to try to create new housing so we've supported the Quality in Housing Project, which will create 80 plus units of supportive housing, and we'll be able to prioritize people who are in emergency housing right now. We are getting to the finish line with Golden Hill, which will create 160 units of also supportive housing. And then we started a new contract with RUPCO this year for them to work closely with families who have been in emergency housing for the longest period of time and try to work hand in hand with them to connect them with any, with all the options for permanent housing that are available. We are also creating a new unit within DSS so that we can have that capability in-house and not just be relying on RUFRA to make those connections. We also started the Housing Action Fund, which has is taking applications right now to try to incentivize the creation of new housing, and we're trying to get occupancy tax, portion of occupancy tax dedicated to funding that every year. And we've also funded the landlord assist, I'm sorry, plus one program to create accessible dwelling units, because that's a very a fast way, an easy way to create new units, and also funding eviction prevention programs. We did a whole year last year to make sure that people get free access to legal advice so that they can stay in their homes for as long as possible. So those are just some of the things that I could think of off the top of my head, but I know that we are trying initiatives across the spectrum of housing, because it can all, it's not within just DSS's, you know, purview to work on the problem, to work on this problem. But I appreciate, you know, I think that this group coming together and continuing to talk about this and seeing if there's any policy options that we haven't tried yet, that would be helpful. I think it's all a really necessary conversation.
Would you want something more?
I just, my experience working with nonprofit housing, I used to do family self-sufficiency program at RUFCO, and there are, and in my role in the county executive's office, I deal with a lot of constituents, and I work a lot with DSS and their staff in order when we have folks that need that extra level of assistance and help work on the housing unit. And I just wanted to stress the units are what will always come down to. You can have subsidies available, you can have funds to pay for things. And in our conversations with RUFCO and having been part of that Section 8 program, I can tell you subsidies are being lost. You only have so much time to use a subsidy once somebody gets a voucher, and people very often will be losing out on vouchers if there aren't units. So the priority being emergency services, all of these pieces that the executive's office and the county is trying to approach are really important, especially when it comes to creating units. So that definitely, you know, is a huge barrier in the folks that I deal with on a regular basis, is having funds to pay for a unit, whether it's a subsidy or not, and then also just locating a unit. Especially when it comes to having needs for a unit, when you're talking about families or, you know, single parent households and that kind of thing, even veterans and seniors, there are needs associated with units, and so they end up in a place where, you know, they've had to turn down something that is available because it's not going to fit those needs. And so it's a complicated thing to address, but it will always come back down to having enough units.
So I'm trying to understand, because I want to be able to understand the difference between an emergency housing that is one type of funding versus a longer term housing. What's the difference and what's the qualification between the two, and how do you distinguish between the two when someone is unhoused?
So the difference between the two is emergency housing are housing units that are available to temporarily shelter someone. So that would be in an emergency shelter that's licensed. We have several of those in our county, Family Inn, Darmstadt, Washburn. So the intention is that individuals or families placed at those shelters, the intention is not that they remain there permanently for any significant length of time. They are intended to be there for a short period of time while they arrive at finding permanent housing that they can move into. Supportive housing is permanent. So a shelter benefit, an ESHI grant, a Section 8 grant, they can all be utilized towards the expense that's incurred for someone to live in supportive housing. They're intended to be residing there permanently for however long that is an appropriate arrangement for them. And then to kind of come full circle, and please stop me because I could talk for several days without being interrupted about this subject matter. One of the reasons why I provided a little bit more information that you had originally requested was really to bring some context to this conversation. I appreciate the approach to try to just have a discussion to educate and get everybody on the same page. And you probably saw the homeless case yes. by month chart that we prepared. And the reason why this is so compelling to not only review but understand
this
is that
in a graph.
In the graph. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
So what I think is so compelling about this data is that when we go back to 2018 and 2019, we see that we had monthly averages that are somewhat similar to what we're experiencing in 2024 and we experienced in 2023. The major differentiation and the most significant dynamic, though, that's not reflected with this data is back in 2018 and 2019, and this goes to what Laura had to say, individuals and families would come into emergency housing but be there for 2 or 3 months. And then they would be able to relocate into permanent housing because back then, Ulster County had adequate inventory for people to be able to move out of emergency housing and back into permanent housing. Now, 2020 is when the pandemic arrives and we have an eviction moratorium. And with regard to our emergency housing, we also automatically continue to certify everybody who was already in emergency housing. So you see our numbers drop to 286 average, 266 in 20 and 2021, and then in 2022 it starts to come back up. But the phenomena that we're really facing right now, which is a big part of this crisis, is that during 2020, 2021, 2022, that's when an enormous amount of pressure has been arrived at being applied on the available permanent housing inventory in Ulster County. At the same time, there's stress being experienced on the emergency housing inventory as well. But we're seeing people in 18, 19 going from being in emergency housing to 2 to 3 months, now for 2 to 3 years, while they're continuing to look for permanent housing to move into. And both Joanna and Laura really addressed that in an articulate way. That's why all of the permanent housing projects that are in the pipeline, which will create more units for this existing emergency homeless population to transition to, will ultimately lead to a reduction in these numbers. Mm-hmm. We always need to have an emergency housing system mm-hmm. that's going to be comprised probably of shelters and hotels and motels, but it's managing that population in the most effective way. And we have structures in place. We have a structure called coordinated entry, where everybody who comes into emergency housing is evaluated and prioritized on their needs based on what inventory is available. Right now, the missing link is there's really no inventory available. We're still realizing some success in transitioning people out of emergency housing into permanent housing, but it's not at the rate or at the volume that it used to be. So that's why I wanted to give some context to these numbers, and the expenses that you alluded to would be dramatically lower if we had people only in emergency housing for 2, 3, 4, 5, even 6 months. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be incurring these high expenditures through those emergency housing programs, which can be $3,000 a month for an individual in a hotel at $100 a night. So I hope that sheds a little bit more light on how all of this sort of fits together and why we find ourselves at this really unique point in time when it's the lack of available, permanent, and affordable and supportive housing inventory for people to be able to transition to that's missing, but it is being worked on.
The same time that those units were getting pressure and getting snapped up was also, it was followed by an intense rise in rent costs, right? Like the fair market rent became really high. And just to go back to the point on subsidies, most of the available subsidies that are available don't cover the actual cost of rents. You know, even what the state prescribes for when they're doing safety net rent for landlords, it doesn't match. Section 8 doesn't match. HUD doesn't seem to understand what the actual rental market costs are, which is fascinating. And it's the same thing when you have to factor in utilities. Utilities are a separate part of the subsidy, which also has to be factored in and calculated. And there's a tenant portion, and there's a portion that's paid for the subsidy. So again, this is also not thinking about just rents when we're talking about subsidizing units. This is also talking about needing to subsidize and adjust for the cost of utilities that these people are having. The other point I wanted to just, to the commissioner's point, at the same time, we also had the closure of major, larger scale units that housed vulnerable populations. CHIS is closed at that time. And so there is a significant portion of these numbers, I believe, and I think the commissioner will confirm, that are consistently being in emergency housing because they've lost that location. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of those types of locations. Unfortunately, the boarding house is another one of those. You have folks that are in very specific vulnerable situations, and they are in those types of locations for very specific reasons. They don't thrive well. They could, in supported housing, they don't thrive well in normal situations because they don't engage well with normal with landlords. And normal is a terrible word to use, and I apologize, but in the more, you know, standard mm-hmm. how people view those things. So it's just another factor to consider, is that that's a large number of people that became unhoused and have consistently remained unhoused and have been consistent. Like they were put into emergency placement and appropriately helped, but getting those folks out of emergency placement is that much harder than finding a location for, say, the family that we helped, the executive's office last summer, that we helped find a unit for. That was much easier to place. They had a subsidy. The unit was still under the size that they needed, but we were able to get them there. So it's just, again, I wanted to just, there's so many layers to this that it's really important to kind of understand that it's never going to be one simple thing, and that there's always those extra pieces.
And my final point, and I promise this is my final point, but every time somebody says something, it triggers But what Laura just mentioned is enormously compelling, and thank you so much for saying it, because between, during this same time, when we go to the chart with the the annual monthly averages, we experience from 2020, 21, and 22 the closure of CHIS's boarding home, Elizabeth Manor, and most recently Chestnut Hill, which cumulatively probably had between 150 to 200 units of housing for individuals who were adults in our community. So all of that housing has been eliminated at the same time of this crisis. And while it may not have been supportive housing, it was community living where some of the individuals relied on each other mm-hmm. for supports around meeting daily responsibilities and daily activities. And that is certainly impacting these high monthly averages that we're seeing. Because where did between 150 to 200 people go in the last 3 years? Some of them left the community and did find housing. Some were lucky to find housing in the community. Others did not. And getting back again to the super challenge around something Laura mentioned, the same time, rents historically rose to levels that your shelter benefit can't afford. So for a single person with a $446 shelter benefit and maybe an $800 Section 8 voucher, maybe
can
they
just
can
really quick interrupt and add to the fact that their utility bills also exponentially tripled during this time period. Continue.
So there you have those enormously unique challenges that just a few years ago weren't present. So pre-pandemic, we did have an emergency housing population, which was very similar to the numbers now. And it was fairly constant, but it was transitioning into permanent housing at a much faster rate. And I think that, again, this kind of paints a more clear picture. The other part is that, you know, emergency housing provision in this county is through the Department of Social Services, Emergency Housing Unit, and Family of Woodstock After Hours. You'll notice on this chart that I provided you with, and mm-hmm. I think you also transitioned yeah. these to graphs. One of the things I really wanted to convey here, you see how significantly we expanded our providers in yeah. 2023. We've had to expand our inventory dramatically mm-hmm. by going out to a much larger range of hotels and motels. And, you know, this happens to be the emergency housing system in most of upstate New York. most counties do not even have any shelters. Most counties rely entirely on the hotels and motels in their community. We're fortunate that we have a family, a single, a youth, and a domestic violence shelter. But even when they're at full capacity, we still see a volume of need that requires that we utilize hotels and motels. And I think Joanna alluded to it. You know, there aren't any particular social services programs that create a pathway for DSS to unilaterally just create
right.
or propose or build additional emergency housing. And one is going to inform the other. If you have more permanent housing inventory coming online, that is going to be able to create somewhere for people in emergency housing to go to. And that's obviously the more beneficial, preferable outcome, so that there's not a lot of continued moving around or dislocation or disruption. But again, you know, these were all dynamics that came together and converged kind of at the beginning of the pandemic. And I think that our county was probably more uniquely impacted than any other county in the state with regard to the influx that we saw of people coming into our county to obtain, you know, single-family residential properties and under six-unit rental properties. And that really kind of had another layer of enormous impact. So whereas our property values benefited, revenues increased from that, our economy benefited, and we've also had historic surpluses, it wasn't something that could be created in a short time frame to replace all that inventory. I promise I'm done.
So I'm going to just review my understanding of what you all said. So the situation that we're in now is we've lost the, what's the term, the sustainable housing, or
large-scale community housing.
Community housing, so we've lost that. We've lost the large-scale community housing. We lost that inventory. So that's putting more people out there. We're not able to transition out of emergency housing as quickly as possible, as quickly as we used to be able to do, and because of the lack of housing at that level, the next level up. So for someone on emergency housing, what is their process? How long do they need to recertify every day? Like, I know that in the city, sometimes they have to like go out of the housing unit in the morning and come back in the afternoon. I mean, how does it work with us here? If you're in emergency housing, how does that work for that individual? What do they have to do to stay in that emergency housing, I guess is the question.
So in order to continue to be eligible for emergency housing, an application has to be completed. The recipient has to be completing housing searches. And then depending on their circumstances, recertifications may need to be done anywhere from 1 month to 3 months.
Okay.
During the COVID pandemic, recertifications were exempted because we were basically sheltering in place for a couple of years. But the harsh reality is, and you know, this is where I think any emergency housing program has to be realistic and implement some flexibility. We know before that even starts that anybody trying to do a housing search in Ulster County who's looking for a one bedroom or a studio is not going to find something that's affordable, because the reason they became emergency homeless was presumably in part because they couldn't afford to continue to live where they were and they don't have adequate income or resources. So if I find myself emergency housed as a single individual and I have limited income or resources, perhaps I'm receiving some type of monthly benefit, or I'm earning, you know, some type of wage, I know that I can't afford $1,200 or $1,400 a month. Anything I look for, I'm not going to be able to afford. So sometimes we do have recipients who contact us and indicate they weren't able to complete the housing search, and we accept that because we know what's really out there in the market.
And good luck finding something at $1,200 or $1,400 a month.
Yeah.
To even become necessarily eligible for, when you're in an application process that's going to potentially compete with other applicants who may have a preference, you know, over someone who presents already in emergency housing, with limited assets and resources, and who might also be dependent on housing program voucher like Section 8 or ESHI. So that's what we're doing. I mean, that's a part of what we do. But, you know, there's frequent engagement, and some of that engagement and some of the programs that the county executive has implemented has been to provide more and more support to the emergency homeless population while they continue to be in their placements, because it can really be a challenging situation to be in.
So what would you guys do? If you could do it. I mean, if you could do it, what would you do?
Can I answer?
Please.
Case managers and units. We build.
We need units.
It's just, I mean, the answer is...
I mean, that seemed like to be my solution, too, but I wanted to ask you guys first.
We need units. We need affordable units that are sustainable for the people living in them that won't necessarily depend on them having to have a specific subsidy. I mean, that's like my pie in the sky, having worked for REPCO. Like, I understand the difficulty of... There's difficulties with Section 8. And there are some people who, the way that their lives are, or their age, or their income, whatever it is, you know, the majority of Section 8, by the way, is seniors, in case anybody ever wonders. It's mostly seniors. I think it's like 70% of them are seniors. But the units, we need to have units. And what I was trying to say with that is the subsidies being attached to the unit and not necessarily the person is a valuable thing in this particular case, because it keeps somebody housed for a longer period of time as opposed to an individual. It's almost like rent control for the unit, as opposed to, and it makes it a safer place in terms of protecting that long-term cost of the unit, affordability of the unit, excuse me. Units. All the units.
Do you have something there?
I was just going to say, and this is, I mean, one thing that we have been working on, I look forward to continuing these discussions with the commissioner and the deputy executive. And Laura, I'm so sorry, I don't even know what your title is.
It's very long, Director of Research and Operational Programs.
Okay, well, there you go. Thank you. One thing that we have been working on together is a program to keep people in their homes. And at the Health and Human Services Committee meeting right after this, we're going to be hearing from Legal Services of the Hudson Valley, and we're hopefully going to be working with them to keep people in their homes by providing rental assistance to landlords. And I'm looking forward to that presentation. I'm also looking forward to arranging another meeting when you guys think it's ready to discuss that. And that's something that I think members of this committee would also want to be aware of and take part in.
Okay.
And I was also going to ask if we could get maybe an update on what's... Well, a couple of comments. I was going to make some comments, and then I'll ask my question. Another thing that happened at the same time of all of this is that the cost of purchasing housing in Ulster County also went through the roof. At one point during the pandemic, Ulster County, or Kingston specifically, was either one or two, depending on how you look at it, the hottest real estate market in the entire country. And that sparked a huge increase in costs. To purchase a house now as opposed to before the pandemic, you're looking at 40, 50, 60% increases in costs. So it's been really dramatic.
Woodstock would double that. I mean, Woodstock is double what it was before. Literally double.
So if you're looking at a house that, you know, basically you can add $100,000 to the price tag of a house in the $200,000 to $300,000 price range. That's what we were looking at now as opposed to then. So it's just really earlier today. I mean, I'm a realtor during my, you know, my day job. And you can see that I'm not at my day job right now. But I mean, there is literally nothing available for under $200,000 in this county that is habitable, period. So the costs of purchasing housing has also just skyrocketed. I'm a little concerned about the amount of time that it's taking for our housing projects to come online. I know that the Golden Hill Penrose project isn't slated until 2026, I believe. And so I was wondering, in light of that and everything that I know that we're all working on so diligently, but I was wondering if we could maybe get an update on what's going on with Elizabeth Manor.
So with just going back for a second, Golden Hill, they're going to close in June, which is great, and hopefully start construction in the fall, which is
excellent.
Also very, very good. So I'm fingers crossed on that. There's so many different pieces to this puzzle between all of the contractors, the projects, the city, there's a water system that needs to be created, and at every single step it's been a lot of, you know, negotiation, and so it's taken them, our partner, longer than they would have liked to get through this process.
Right.
But from working with them, they're very, like, they're diligent and they're pushing forward as fast as they can get through this process.
That's great to hear.
Elizabeth Manor, I don't have anything I can share yet. We're working on it. I mean, that was part of, like, this whole, part of the whole conversation. You can see these costs, the reliance on hotels and motels, and the impact of those types of places closing is why we wanted to create another shelter in the county, so that we're not, you know, relying on these hotels and motels and these costs keep going up. Having said that, there were concerns with the cost of creating that shelter, so we've been trying to find other solutions since then, and it's hard for nonprofits as well, because they have the same funding constraints that government has. So we're trying to find a solution. We don't have anything that we can announce yet, but we're really hoping to create, to get those units back online, get units at that location, because we need them.
And if I could just add one more thing real quick, one thing that I've been advocating for ever since I served on the town board in Marbletown is housing at SUNY Ulster campus, and I understand that is now something that is being considered, and so that's great, and I hope that we can follow up with the discussion on that as well.
That's something
I just want to say that I hope this committee can get to a point where we can discuss low income housing. For me, when you say affordable housing, what's affordable? And two, if it's affordable, who is it affordable to? Certainly not the most vulnerable. So if we build, let's call it low income housing, and truly make it that. If we do that, and we'll get more people off the street, in my opinion.
Yes, sir, yeah.
Yeah, oh boy. I'm just going to popcorn here for a minute, and then maybe we'll see if any of it's worthwhile. Somebody did mention to me the idea of restarting, but I'm a little unclear what was started in the first place. Some sort of community advisory board, working group, think tank, brain trust, let's fill in that blank. But I know we have a tremendous amount of expertise and passion in the community. And this committee is three people. So I'm wondering if there is some way in which we could utilize the passions of our friends and neighbors to create a compendium of some of what we want to look into and task them with doing it, because they want to.
I think that was referring to the various working groups that were created around housing by the last legislature. So one of them was emergency housing, one of them was, I think, affordable housing, and then there was another one, but there were a few different groups, working groups, mm-hmm. and they did have members of the community participate in them. They didn't, I think Kathy was on one of them.
Yep.
Yeah. I think you could characterize it better, because I wasn't part of the groups, but...
There were subcommittees of the Public Health Committee, it was emergency, and then short-term, and then I think long-term,
right.
maybe housing was the third one. And the different groups had different focus. There was some of the legislation that we worked on last year came from some of those working groups. I was the chair of the emergency group, and we didn't have many concrete suggestions because we felt that DSS needed to basically do what it was doing. They've hired some additional staff, and I think that's really helping. Because they had the role to respond. We looked at the question of the immigrants and felt that they did not have a role, that the immigrant population is small in Ulster County and is not a big contributor to the need for emergency housing because they use family networks.
Yeah.
One of the things we had on our agenda that still I think would make sense was more outreach to the churches. Many of the churches used to have a bigger role in housing, especially emergency housing, and that's something that is difficult, but that it, with proper community supports, could play a role.
So no arguments out of me there.
Can I just add, the continuum of care is a huge resource of all of these wonderful passionate organizations and people, and it meets regularly in the county executive's office, joined it and became a part of it last year. And we've been actively attending meetings and using those meetings and those connections in order to get best practices and to engage them in partnerships more in-depthly in order to, like, our, the housing unit we came up with for DSS came from those conversations with the continuum of care, which had all of these wonderful organizations and these people, and it was very strategically identified as one of the pieces which would assist these folks in emergency placement to locate and get into permanent housing. You know, that's the other thing I would have added besides units is people who can be flexible and help folks because they are lacking in capacity very often to deal with applications and credit checks and talking to landlords and effectively communicating and finding subsidies and all of it. It's a lot. It's a lot for people who aren't going through crisis.
So
if you're in crisis and your life is generally crisis and you have to take care of all things, it's just that much harder.
Absolutely.
And so having people who can be flexible and understand and respond with that empathy, I think, is really important. And it's
So that sounds like a place that I should direct those folks to.
And we're happy to make that connection. I'm sorry.
For anybody who doesn't know, the Continuum of Care is a it's an organized group but required by HUD, right? Which includes all of the organizations that are involved in providing housing or connecting people to housing
or services related
or
to housing.
Services.
Yeah.
So like Family of Woodstock, People USA, Gateway.
There's churches everyone. And
Kingston Housing Authority. Mm-hmm.
The Housing
Ulster County.
To be a part of that,
Right. Mental Health Department, Social Service,
I've never even heard of that,
together.
So thank you.
And they meet monthly.
And there's multiple subcommittees that they've been, and they've expanded their subcommittees to really kind of be more strategic and tackle a lot of these things. So I think it might be worth it to connect Kathy Germain with you all to kind of come and talk about the role.
That
would be great.
There was one piece I was going to say from that, and I completely slipped my brain.
I think on the last piece of
the COC. Oh, it's also organized by CARES New York. I'm sorry.
CARES New York is the organization that basically compiled all of the information and data that the COC membership provides, and as was said, the membership is comprised of entities that basically are participating in providing some kind, and for the most part, it's permanent housing. And this includes, again, Section 8 grants, ESHAG grants, other kinds of smaller programs. And what it does, it comes together and it applies to HUD every year for specific grant funding for an enormous amount of additional programming. So I think it would be a wonderful suggestion if Kathy Germain could come and just do a brief presentation on what the COC is and what it does, because it is not as widely known of an organization among a lot of individuals and entities that really care about this. And I'll just add quickly is that, you know, the question, what should we do? And, you know, I'll say this with some conditions. I think we're doing what we need to do. I think we're doing what we need to do, which is that we have programming in place to be responsive to the emergency housing needs that we're seeing. We've taken significant steps to implement programming to support the emergency homeless population. We have many projects in the pipeline that are going to create more units. I would put the emphasis on we have to build more units of supportive affordable permanent housing. That is really where I think the focus, and we have to bring maybe a renewed sense of urgency to the projects that we're all waiting to see happen. And how that renewed sense of urgency is arrived at is not necessarily through criticisms or pressure, but through just creating any kind of support for the pathways that have to be navigated to get to, you know, completion and launching. Because we all know that one of the major dynamics is when the municipalities play a role in issuing permits, navigating around zoning, and just continuing to create more support and momentum. You know, Ulster County has become incredibly, and has been for a long time, a desirable place to live, but will never not benefit from creating more units of thoughtful housing, because this will continue to be a wonderful, desirable place that people will seek to come to live and will want to remain there living. And I think that, you know, what can we do? And again, you don't want to have all kinds of emergency housing to the degree that that's where people are languishing. You want to have, obviously, adequate emergency housing, and you want to have emergency housing that is meeting needs and it's safe to be at, and you're getting supported while you're in it. But the goal has to be, you know, permanent housing. You know, and all of these events that transpired got us a little bit into a difficult place in terms of, you know, I don't think anybody could have predicted, you know, the loss of inventory, and the real estate perspective was also, you know, a compelling one as well.
I have a couple of things I want to ask, if that's okay, before I...
Go for it.
You said more units. How many? Rough guess. Hundreds, thousands, millions, I don't know how many.
Look at our planning.
Supportive housing.
I mean, I know that there has...
Supportive housing, how many units do we need?
We have not done what I would call a fair share calculation. The state has now sort of stepped into that with the pro-housing legislation. And by the way, my name is Dennis Doyle. I'm the planning director for the county. And my apologies to the committee. I was double booked, as they say. We haven't done a fair share calculation, but what I would say to you is that we're in a paradox where effectively the county's population is not growing, but its housing needs are. And one of the reasons for that is the fact that A, we're taking units out of circulation, out of being available because of our short-term rental issues and second home issues, which are continue to grow and expand. And the second thing that's happening is, and it's hard to understand, but as population family size decreases, you need more units to house the same number of people.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And what's happened since the 70s, we had about 3.25 people per household. We're now down in the twos. And so if you do that across 180,000 people, then all of a sudden the numbers... Mm-hmm. significantly increase in terms of the housing units you need. Doesn't answer your question, but what I would say to you is that at a minimum, what we need is at least for the problem not to get any worse, we need to at least to see 15-20% of all new units be affordable, at a minimum of that. And by affordable, I mean 80% or more or less of AMI. If I had to look at a number of units, I'd probably be talking somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3,000 to 5,000 units in the next 10 years. And that's a fairly large number, but I'll give you the sense that the city of Kingston is conversation right now with respect to additional units is 1,000 more units by 2030.
I'm sorry, what was the number that you quoted?
3 to 5.
3 to 5?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Somewhere in that nature. That's off the top of my head, so haven't done that.
Well, it gives us a scale.
I mean, it's calculation.
It's thousands.
You would be really surprised to know that currently since 2019 to where we are today, there's somewhere in a neighborhood of about 2,500 units that are gone through the approval process or going through the approval process that have not yet, and of those, about half of those essentially have gone through and been approved. But what we're seeing is more and more resistance with respect to something that the commissioner was touching on. more and more resistance to approvals and the time it takes to get approvals. You would think that, the reason for that is because the zoning statutes are not conducive to multiple family housing. You would find that that's not the case in most municipalities. Most municipalities are fairly liberal with respect to the allowing multifamily units. The difficulty is the approval processes are not necessary. There's no certainty in the approval process, and there are more than enough individuals that will take communities to court and hold those approval processes up so they last long, really long periods of time. To give you an example of the extreme issues associated with that, we had a situation in Hamlet in the town of Olive where a 12-lot subdivision was 2.5 years. Okay. Right. Those are things that ends up happening. So one of the things that we did with respect to, let me know if I'm taking too much time here.
I'd love to hear you talk more, but I have a deadline, right?
Fine.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I piggyback on that point? I think another way to kind of look at the supported housing needs would be to look at the wait list for things like SPOA. SPOA's had an extensive wait list for a number of years.
SPOA, please describe.
Oh, SPOA is supported housing. Single point of access. It's supported housing for people who have greater levels of disabilities and issues.
Okay. It's run by the Department of Mental Health.
My brain went to what it is, not to what it stands for, Kathy. I appreciate you.
They're the single point of access for all these types of supported housing.
Yes, so they can have housing and then they are able to get supported services. There's a very limited number of those units that exist, and believe there's some kind of bureaucracy as to how those units come to exist and how those units are paid for. Even if something is not a SPOA-specific housing, that type of housing is the housing that would have served the people who left Chiz's, would have served the people who left Elizabeth Manor, who would serve the people who are now out of Chestnut Manor.
And if I may, my comments are on the general need of housing. Mm-hmm. If you had to pick a crisis with respect to housing, it's the supportive housing crisis, right? The emergency housing crisis. That we know that we really need, we don't have enough of those units anywhere, and they're really, really, really difficult to site because of community opposition. Mm-hmm. We do have one project that's 83 units. It's the Quality Inn project. The legislature's provided some money for water and sewer out there, but the project is short on cash right now. It's looking for how it's going to close that. Other counties have an inventory of these types of housings. If you looked over in Dutchess County, you looked down in Orange County, the county and the nonprofits have participated together to find
the Deborah?
Yeah.
Okay, that's where
one
of the officials are.
So in Ulster County, we literally have relied on, to a certain extent, the ability of nonprofits to do this, and they have difficulty with respect to siting. And then the commissioner is forced to rely on the motels and hotels relative to do that. And when you look at the time in motels and hotels, they're really approaching almost permanent housing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's worth it to have conversations with organizations like Devereaux, which does a lot of those. They do have houses in Ulster County. There's actually one, surprisingly, near my house, which is a rather conservative ward, to be honest with you. But it's very small numbers of people because they are residential houses that they transition into into essentially like a community housing that has like common areas and everybody has their own rooms. It's very similar to how Elizabeth Manor was set up, but less industrial when you get down to the kitchen aspect of it. But I mean, if you were to go for a solid number, can we just say 500?
You could say 500.
500 easily.
Supportive housing.
Yeah.
Okay, next question.
I want to see your 500 and raise it 5.
Okay. So we'll go with 1,000.
Let's go big.
So next question I have, and I have 5 minutes to get this answered. Ulster County Housing Authority. Is it a good idea, a bad idea? What do you think of it?
I didn't
catch it. Ulster County Housing Authority, forming Housing Authority. Can we do it? How do we do it? Is it worth doing? Is it part of a solution or not part of a solution?
So my first answer is most of the housing authorities, and there's several that exist. There's one in Saugerties, there's one in Kingston. Obviously, there's one in Kingston and Allenville. Yep. They were the product of the HUD housing issues in the 60s and 70s. they have struggled with respect to their ability to make the necessary improvements and also with respect to some of the management issues regarding that. the question then becomes that you currently have legislation being considered at the state level to create a state housing authority, which would act like local housing authorities. I don't know how much legs that has, but your representative from this area is currently trying to move that legislation forward. My sense is that if you don't want to rely on the nonprofit sector, private sector, then you do have a housing development corporation that it was formed to do that kind of work. It's not resourced in any way, shape, or form. I would hate to continue to create organizational structure rather than to buttress the organizational structure or capacity that's in place.
Okay. Do you mind, Commissioner Clay? So the other piece to this is that even if you were to create an Ulster County Housing Authority, the housing authorities have also, like, to Doyle, Dennis's point, the housing authority is Doyle.
That's the nicest thing she called me this week.
Rondout Housing Authority, the Kingston Housing Authority, Rondout Gardens is right across from my house. And that's a really great example. If you look into what's going on there, they've struggled with the type of subsidies they're offering, and they're actually expanding the type of units they have to have ones that are not necessarily subsidized units, but they're fair market units because of these issues. So I thoroughly support Dennis's point that creating that additional bureaucracy, I don't necessarily think is the answer, especially if it's based on a model that is currently struggling and not working. You'd also have to consider a housing authority still needs units. It still needs a method of paying for them. And when it comes to subsidizing them, it's not so simple, because you'd really have to navigate the funding coming from HUD and coming from state, you know, in HCR, and really figuring out how that would work. RUPCO, for example, has again been going to project-based vouchers instead of doing as much Section 8. And just for color on history here, Section 8 used to have an Ulster County preference. And somewhere in the federal policy, that's where I was going with that. They're not allowed to. And so the other kind of difficult thing is, if Ulster County does do a housing authority, project-based vouchers would make more sense, because it would be attached to the unit, not the individual. The issue with Section 8 very often is that you have a finite number of vouchers. If I decided to go get a voucher, I could come to Ulster County and get my voucher. I could say, peace out, I'm going to go move to Guam. You literally could take your Section 8 voucher to Guam, in case you're wondering, and Puerto Rico. So flexibility, people being able to be mobile is important, but you could essentially end up completely missing the population you're trying to help, because you'd be sending your vouchers elsewhere. So,
and are landlords required to accept these vouchers? That's another issue.
No, landlords are not required. No, if a housing authority, again, we're kind of talking about something. Kingston House Authority, it's their units. You can't take a Kingston Housing Authority voucher and go elsewhere.
But regular Section 8 vouchers are portable.
And that's what I mean by portable. You can take your voucher elsewhere, like I said, to Guam, Oklahoma, wherever you want to go, as long as you are going to a place that has a Section 8 program. You messed up my point, though. Where was I going with that?
The law as it relates basically doesn't allow them to decide where income is coming from with respect to the ability to pay rent. The problem that you have with respect to Section 8 vouchers is that there's currently, outside of the housing authorities which hold vouchers, Section 8 vouchers, there's currently about 1,700 vouchers that are held by RUPCO that are out there now. The difficulty you have is Section 8 vouchers are based on fair market rent, HUD fair market rent. And when you look at HUD, fair market rent, right, it's below what actual rents are available in Ulster County. And so since the individuals are not allowed to pay more than 30% of their income, they literally can't make up the difference.
Right. The piece that I wanted to also mention here before I forget it is that if somebody has a Kingston Housing Authority voucher, and you can get to a Section 8 voucher, you can't port, you have to apply for the same wait list, but then that person can't live in the city of Kingston. So there's very interesting rules around housing authorities, and so that's what I want to stress, so if somebody lives in Sarri's Housing Authority, they get a Section 8 voucher, they won't necessarily be able to stay in their community, because the voucher requirements, the voucher rules require them to move out of their current jurisdiction in order to get the voucher. Mm. So you'd kind of be messing people up in Ulster County if they already lived in Ulster County. You know what I'm saying? So it's, yeah, it's very but difficult.
An HDC, I think, is more flexible, yes, in what, yeah, it, okay, allows us to do. Yes. So. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think one thing that we should talk about moving forward, and Dennis can probably speak to this a lot more than I can, but encouraging the municipalities to adopt more standardized zoning practices so that the developers who do want to build can build. But that's, you know, I mean, that is something that will just speed up the process. That will speed up the process if every single development doesn't have to be negotiated in its own individual terms. That is a movement,
yes,
that is happening.
I spent 2.5 years of my life getting Woodstock to try to do, yes, a zoning change, well, which they've not done yet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would comment on that. I'm a big fan of the concept, but I'm not of a housing authority, mm-hmm, but I'm not necessarily sure that any county really has the wherewithal to be able to take on the enormous responsibilities to really do what the housing authority is directed to do, which is siting, building, operating, funding.
Yeah.
I mean, there is legislation that Dennis alluded to right now to revive New York State Housing Authority to create what's being defined as social housing, mm-hmm, for supportive housing, low income. And I think it might begin to get some momentum. It did exist previously. In the early 70s, there was a New York State Housing Authority, and I think it was called Mitchell Llama Housing.
Mitchell, yep, Llama, it still exists.
And it still exists.
Yep. Some of the facilities that were built still exist, mm-hmm, throughout the state and are still viable. And I do think that it is something that, again, is a viable idea, but you have to be a large entity, I think, like a state, to really be able to, you know, carry forward. And that's why, again, I would say, while we need more units, we need to come together in a way to address this, again, thoughtfully, to get people on board with the urgency, where we can remove obstacles, where we can garner support, where we can, with the housing fund, begin to support proposals, you know, that maybe exist through private, not-for-profit partnerships, because that funding is there, but, you know, in a way that maybe we can start to reduce a little bit of the resistance that begins to be incurred sometimes when these projects get proposed. So that would be my take on it. I think a housing authority would be biting off a little more than we can chew, and I think we find ourselves, again, you know, trying to overcome insurmountable obstacles and hurdles to get anything off the ground.
Okay. I'm going to ask for motion to adjourn because we're backing people up behind us here.
That's
a great conversation,
right?
First of all. I really appreciate all of your guys' insights. I really appreciate you coming and talking to us about it. I know I have a lot to learn, and I'm learning it very slowly. Hopefully, I can learn it a little faster. It's a big issue, and we really need to focus on it and come up with solutions as quickly as possible. And I agree with everything you said about, we can talk about it, but we need to start building. We need to start getting things out there. We can't, yeah, delay all of this. So is there a motion to adjourn?
It's got to be you, I guess.
Luckily, a motion to adjourn is 90 seconds, so all in favor of adjourning.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.